From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The following are all true ghost stories from around the world. Peru. Poltergeist of the Andes. During the 1930s, a young American mining engineer named Jack Baraguanth spent a number of years knocking around the wildest regions of Chile and Peru. In the course of his wanderings, he had many exciting and dramatic experiences. The Andes country in particular seemed to encourage the unearthly and the weird. But one adventure involving poltergeist manifestations stood out in his mind above all the others. When he was 27, Jack's company sent him to a small village in central Peru. He was to take charge of the operation of a small but very rich copper mine. The name of the village was Jaja, located about 80 miles east of Lima in the Andes chain. One day a French priest, Father Conde, with whom Jack had become acquainted, came to see him. Jack noted that the priest, usually calm and collected, appeared to be in quite a flustered state. "What's the trouble, Father?" asked Jack. "Oh, my friend," said the priest, rather breathlessly, "I have something I must discuss with you. There's a very queer thing going on in the town." A few days before, the priest told him, an Indian named Vasquez had begged him to come to his home. He wished him to exorcise some spirits that had taken possession of the place and were driving him and his poor family frantic. For over a week, it seemed Vasquez and his household had been repeatedly struck by stones thrown by invisible hands while they were all inside the house. Vasquez said that sometimes this happened during the day, but more frequently at night, even though the doors were closed and the shutters bolted securely. "I tell you," continued Father Conde, "Vasquez was exceptionally excited, almost hysterical. I couldn't doubt his word that something really disturbing was going on. So I went to his house, and it was just as he said. I saw the stones falling myself. I tried some of the rites to lay the ghost, but it did no good. I'm completely baffled. Maybe you'd like to go see for yourself." The strange situation interested Jack very much, and he suggested they call on the Vasquez family together. Father Conde thought they should go immediately, so they set out for the house. On the way, they met the mayor of the town, explained what was going on, and asked if he'd like to go with them. The mayor agreed to go. The three men went directly to the Vasquez house, a one-story structure of adobe brick, roofed over with rough tile. Inside, the visitors found a combination living room and kitchen, a bedroom and a storeroom. Jack and the others learned that the family consisted of Vasquez, his wife, and three girls whose ages ranged from 8 to 15 years. Vasquez's wife was in a hysterical condition. Her face and hands were covered with bruises and bumps, and the girls also had many bruises. The family showed the three men a pile of rocks, ranging in size from pebbles to cobblestones, and there were also pieces of broken tile and lumps of hard, dried mud. All of these, said the mother, had been hurled at them during the past 10 days. Curiously, none of the objects had struck Vasquez himself. Furthermore, no member of the family had been hit while outside the house. The men inspected the premises carefully. Then, deciding to try an experiment, they took a chair from the living room and placed it in the middle of the nearly empty storeroom. Then the visitors persuaded one of the daughters to sit in it. This was the middle child, an intelligent-looking girl of about 12. Her head and face were badly bruised and cut. They then closed the heavy door leading to the living room, and the three men, Jack, Father Conde, and the mayor, stood shoulder to shoulder in the doorway, with their backs against the door. Facing them was the girl in the center of the room. Behind her was a window with four small panes set in a deep frame in the adobe wall. The window, which gave out onto the street, was nailed tightly shut. There was no other opening into the storeroom. Previously, the three had carefully examined the walls, ceiling, and hard mud floor. There was no place where anybody or any large object could possibly be concealed. We stood there tense and expectant, Jack later recalled, for quite a while. Nothing happened, and after about 20 minutes, our gaze, which had been fixed on the girl, may have wandered. I mention this to allow for any benefit of doubt about what happened. Suddenly we heard a noise like a dull slap, followed by a thud. Then we saw, rolling across the floor, away from the girl, a stone about as large as a man's two fists. The stone had already struck the girl on the cheek with enough force to jerk her sideways, though not hard enough to knock her off the chair. The girl burst into sobs, but remained seated on the chair. Jack and Father Conde remained where they were, but the mayor, in great excitement, rushed over to the stone and picked it up. "This cannot be," he shouted. Keeping the heavy door closed, the three visitors went over the walls and ceilings of the room, inch by inch, trying to find a place where a stone might have been tossed through. But none was found. The girl, Jack subsequently related, had been hit on the cheek, so the stone would have had to come from one side of the room. All three of us could have sworn that there had been no stones on the floor, and if that girl had had it concealed on her person, she would have had to be a sleight-of-hand artist. Jack also emphasized that from the sound of the thud and the effect of the blow, it appeared to have been thrown underhand from a distance of about 6 feet. Therefore, it could not possibly have come from the ceiling or from either the window or the door, even if those had been open. The three investigators were completely perplexed. They also saw with deep pity that the little Vasquez girl's cheek was beginning to swell, and they did what they could to soothe her. While Father Conde and the mayor of Jauja remained with the shaken family, Vasquez went out and brought some little presents for the Vasquez girls and some beer for the father and mother. When the three men left them, the family was at least as happy as it could be under the strange circumstances. Jack Baragwanath continued to follow the case carefully. The strange stone attacks kept up for about a week more, then ceased as suddenly as they had commenced. For years, the young mining engineer tried to figure out some explanation for the odd events, but by his own admission, he never could. From Russia, The Dancing Poltergeist. One of the best-known cases of poltergeist activity in Russia began in November of 1870. It was unique in two respects. First, the poltergeist did not manifest itself with the usual flying crockery, stones, or other objects. Rather, it took the form of audible dancing steps. Second, in its final manifestation, the poltergeist actually took on incendiary abilities. A wealthy landowner named Gregor Shapov had been away from his large country estate near Orensburg in Ulursk province on a business trip. When he got back on November 16th, he discovered his whole household in a turmoil over what was apparently a ghost who danced. 2 days before, said his young wife, Helena, their infant daughter had cried incessantly and refused to go to sleep. She then asked their cook, Maria, to entertain the baby until she fell asleep. Accordingly, Maria took the harmonica to the child's room and began to play for the little girl. Meanwhile, Elena had gone on chatting in the living room with her friend, the local miller's wife. "Maria's very good with children," Elena had remarked to her friend. "If her harmonica playing doesn't put the little one to sleep, she dances for her. That always does the trick." After a few minutes, the two women heard Maria dancing a brisk three-step dance for the child. Soon afterwards, Maria had entered the living room and announced that the baby was fast asleep. Mrs. Shapov had thanked the cook and dismissed her. Maria then told her mistress that she was going right to bed and retired to her quarters in the rear of the house. Helena and the miller's wife had not been chatting for long when suddenly they heard a wild disturbance in the attic above their heads. The two women had stared at each other, mystified by the odd sounds. At first there were flurries of insane rappings with no discernible beat or rhythm to them. But then they had slowed and become measured and rhythmic. Finally, they sounded exactly like the three-step dance that Maria had just performed for the child. "Can that be Maria up there?" Helena had said. "It sounds just like her dancing." "I don't see how," the miller's wife had replied. "We would have seen her pass by us to get there." Helena told Gregor that she and her friend had walked out of the living room and back to the cook's quarters. Opening the door quietly, they had seen Maria sound asleep in her bed. "That settles it," Helena had muttered in a frightened voice. "We've got to see who's up in the attic." The dancing sounds had not stopped. It had taken willpower for the terrified women to make their way up the stairs to the attic. Helena had a lantern with her, and they stretched and searched the attic, but they found no one up there. Still, the dancing noises could be heard. Although the two women had made a hasty retreat downstairs, the rapping noises of the dancing appeared to race ahead of them, shaking the walls and rattling the windows. The miller's wife had then rushed off to fetch her husband and the gardener, while Helena went to see if her baby was all right. When the miller's wife returned with her husband and the gardener, the loud dancing sounds had increased in intensity. So loud had they become that Helena's mother and mother-in-law and Maria too had awakened. Although the miller and the gardener searched the house and grounds thoroughly, they had found nothing. Yet the dancing sounds persisted until daybreak. The following evening, around 10 o'clock, the dancing ghost once again began its rendition of the three-step. Although the house and estate were patrolled by servants and by neighbors who had heard of the strange goings-on, the invisible ghost danced on once more until daybreak. After Gregor had heard all this, he shook his head in disbelief. He asked his wife whether she had been drinking his vodka and just imagined the whole wild tale. "No," protested his wife, "she had nothing to drink." A practical, down-to-earth man, Gregor took little stock in stories of the supernatural. What he could not touch or see, he simply did not believe. Turning to his mother and mother-in-law, he demanded to know whether they verified the tale told by his wife. "It's true, Gregor," affirmed his mother. "Something supernatural has come to this house." The landowner shrugged and frowned, then made a remark about women concocting crazy stories that could only frighten servants and keep them from their tasks. Then he dispatched Maria to get the miller, whom he regarded as a very sensible and reliable person. When he arrived, Gregor asked him to substantiate the women's tale of the dancing ghost. The miller did so, saying it was correct in all details. However, he added, a couple of days ago, he had removed a pigeon's nest from under one of the eaves of the house. Maybe the troublesome bird had returned, gone into the house somehow, and was responsible for the odd noises everyone was hearing. Delighted at this explanation, the stubborn Shapoff clapped the miller on the back and grinned broadly. "Naturally," he exclaimed, "that is doubtless the cause of all this nonsense." Feeling safer now that the landowner had returned, the whole household went to bed early. They were exhausted from the weird experiences of the past 2 days. Saying good night, Gregor stayed downstairs and decided to read for a while before turning in. At a little past 10 o'clock, however, he was distracted by some scratching noises above him. That, he thought, was probably the pigeon come back to the house, roaming around somewhere upstairs. But a few seconds later, as he listened closely, the noises changed into regular beats and taps, as if someone were dancing the three-step. Thinking it must be his young wife having a bit of fun with him, Gregor put his book aside and went upstairs to Helena's room. He paused a few moments before her door to be sure that this was the source of the dancing sounds. It was, and he resolved to give his wife a good talking to. But when he slowly opened the door, the dancing sounds stopped immediately, and he saw that Elena was in her bed sleeping soundly, even snoring a little. Mystified, Gregor was just shutting the door again when he heard multiple rappings coming from somewhere above Elena's bed. He tiptoed over to the bedstead and cocked one ear to the adjacent wall to listen more carefully to the sounds. Just as he did so, there came a deafening rap from the wall that nearly ruptured his eardrum. It also woke his wife, who sat straight up in bed, her lips pursed in a near scream, but she calmed down when she saw her husband. "Gregor, what was that?" she exclaimed. "Did you hear it?" "I didn't hear a thing," he lied, now wishing to upset his wife. Then, as if to punish him for the lie, came two thundering knocks that resounded through the whole house. "I have had enough of this crazy business," declared Gregor angrily. "I've got to stop it." With that, he put on his coat and grabbed a gun from a drawer. Downstairs, he told some of the frightened servants to follow him, got out his watchdogs, and searched thoroughly about the house and grounds. Search as he would, the frustrated landowner could find no mischievous prankster on whom to blame the disturbances. But a curious thing about the dancing sounds which still continued was noticed by all that night. To those searching outside the house, the loud tappings appeared to be coming from inside. Yet, to those who remained inside, it appeared as if someone were trying to batter the house down from without. Thwarted in his efforts to find the source of the sounds, Gregor finally called off the search in disgust. The next night, after a fruitless all-day combing of the grounds, Shapoff decided to invite some of his neighbors in to bear witness to the ghost. Promptly at 10 o'clock, the time when the disturbances usually began, the invisible dancer began to perform. All night long, it danced the familiar three-step. Then, for a finale, it delivered such an explosive blow to a door that it was half torn from its hinges. By the following night, Gregor himself had become convinced that something supernatural had invaded his house. Dreading the approach of 10 o'clock, he paced around restlessly until that hour arrived. But on this night, the landowner and his family were amazed to hear nothing at all. No scratchings, taps, or invisible feet dancing the three-step. It appeared that peace had come once again to the Shapoff country estate, and the poltergeist had departed. 4 weeks later, just before Christmas, Gregor and his wife were entertaining guests, and the subject of the recent disturbances came up. The guests were skeptical that such phenomena were possible. Annoyed, Gregor then tempted fate and called on Maria the cook to perform her three-step dance. Probably all the ghost needed, he told his guest, was a little coaxing to reappear again. Ignoring Helena's entreaties not to go through with this, Gregor motioned for Maria to begin dancing. She did so briskly. Almost immediately afterward, a flurry of rappings was heard at the windows. Then, as the guests listened in disbelief, they heard a perfect repetition of the cook's dance coming from the attic. "Ah," one guest accused the landowner, "you've got someone else up there doing the dancing." However, when Shapoff and some of the guests explored the attic, there was no one there. Again, at a New Year's Eve party, Gregor ordered Maria to do her three-step dance to induce the invisible dancing ghost to come forth. Cramming the house with many guests, and after Maria stopped, they heard the repetitive echoes of her three-step from the ceiling above them. On this occasion, the poltergeist was not content merely to put on its dancing act. It became so spirited and animated that it made some crude attempts at vocalizing snatches of Russian folk songs. As a result of these two holiday parties, stories began to spread about the queer happenings at the Shapoff's country mansion. In time, both scientists and spiritualists came to seek an audience with a dancing ghost. Some tried to communicate with it by a series of knocks, but were unsuccessful. At length, word of these goings on reached the governor of Orsak province, who appointed a small committee of scientists to investigate the matter. This body eventually came to the conclusion that Helena Shapoff was producing the disturbances by some sort of trickery. A sharply worded letter of warning was dispatched to Gregor not to let the phenomena continue. Yet they did continue, and with a vengeance. Content before with merely rapping and dancing the three-step, the poltergeist now commenced its incendiary manifestations. It was Helena who was always at the center of these attacks. Balls of fire were seen to circle the house, and they often bounced against the windows of her room, as if seeking to enter and do her harm. Several times dresses in her closets burst into flame, and servants had to pour water on them. Once her mattress began burning from underneath. The climax to these fiery events came one day when Helena was chatting with a miller and a house guest. All heard a crackling noise that seemed to come from under the floor of the living room. This was followed by a long, shrill, howling sound. Then a blue spark appeared to pop up from the floor at Helena, and immediately her thin dress caught fire. Before the horrified men, she became a virtual pillar of fire. Screaming in terror, she collapsed in a dead faint. With great courage and presence of mind, the house guest soon had the flames out, beating at them with his bare hands. The strange thing was that the guest suffered severe burns on his hands and arms, while Helena sustained not even a blister, though her dress was almost completely consumed by the flames. At this point, the Shapovs had had their fill of the dancing ghost, which had now become a dangerous menace that could deal out fiery destruction. Gregor closed up his country estate and moved into a townhouse in Niletsky. From that time on, the disturbances ceased, and Helena, whose health had grown steadily worse due to the poltergeist onslaughts, recovered quickly. Unfortunately, the young woman died 8 years later in childbirth. Psychic researchers have continued to speculate about this unusual poltergeist case to the present day. They all agree that the person of Helena Shapov seemed to offer the poltergeist its center of energy. Although poltergeist activity normally focuses around children and teenagers, Helena was not far from being a teenager herself. She was only 20 when the manifestations began. Some experts have theorized that some psychic shock, perhaps in her marriage, had liberated a powerful psychokinetic energy from her main personality, so that subconsciously she herself willed the phenomena. Or perhaps other researchers have theorized a psychic residue of energy in the Shapov mansion, perhaps built up by the former residents, had found a sympathetic energy source in young Elena's psyche or soul. This theory of poltergeist activity holds that a focus of bottled up energy in the psychic atmosphere can release itself violently when a person with a right telepathic affinity comes on the scene to trigger it. If so, Helena seems to have been that person. From Scotland, the haunted shores of Sandwood Bay. Situated at the extreme northwestern tip of the Scottish mainland, Cape Wrath is well named. In spite of its desolate beauty, the cape is incessantly lashed by frantic seas, and its rock-bound coast is littered with the skeletons of wrecked ships that dared brave the Atlantic in those northern latitudes. One bleak, isolated beach on Cape Wrath is known as Sandwood Bay. There, one fall afternoon in the 1930s, a Scots tenant farmer and his son ventured further than usual from their fields in search of firewood. The two spoke little as they roamed along the beach, gathering wood from the wrecks on the utterly deserted Sandwood Bay dunes. So far had they wandered with their small pony that they found themselves in this strange region and did not know that the beach on which they were working was thought to be haunted. The inhabitants of nearby Durness and other villages were accustomed to visitors coming back from Sandwood Beach with scary tales of an apparition and odd happenings, both on the beach and around some of its deserted cottages. Interrupting his wood-gathering, the son glanced over the western horizon at the declining sun. "Father," he began, "night's coming. We'd best be heading home now." The older man, who raised his eyes to the sun, "Aye, we'll be on our way now, lad." Just then the little pony neighed skittishly. The two men whirled around to see what had disturbed the animal, and were abruptly aware that a man was confronting them not far away. "Evening, sir," stammered the startled farmer. "We did nay see you standing there." The stranger appeared to be a seaman of some sort. A short, bearded man, he wore sea boots, an officer's peaked cap, and a dark blue jacket with brass buttons. These articles of clothing, the two farmers later recalled, looked like those that a mariner of the previous century might have worn. The stranger stared at them and then yelled in a hollow, cavernous voice, "My property! This is my property! Do you understand? Drop it and leave this place!" Astonished and filled with terror, The farmer and his son promptly dumped all the wood they had accumulated and, grabbing the pony's reins, fled the beach for home. A few years later, on a sunny summer afternoon, the same stocky, seafaring figure was seen by the members of a large fishing party. These witnesses noticed particularly that the figure was wearing a peaked mariner's cap and a dark blue jacket. The latter was adorned with brass buttons that glinted in the sun's rays. The members of the fishing party first saw the figure standing next to a sandy mound. Next, they saw it walk slowly along the crest of a dune and then vanish behind a hillock. Thinking that the man might be a poacher, the leader of the fishing party dispatched a servant across the beach to investigate. Several minutes later, the servant returned. Shaken and white-faced, he reported that he had seen no one at all. Moreover, he could find no footprints in the sand at the spot where they had all seen the sailor. Still standing today high atop the ridge facing Cape Wrath Lighthouse, amid heather and bracken, about a mile from the dunes of Sandwood Bay, are the remains of Sandwood Cottage. Untenanted for over four decades, it is probably the most remote and solitary dwelling on the Scottish mainland. No road, not even a trail, leads to it. Here in the early 1960s, an old fisherman named Angus Morrison, unwilling to continue his long journey home after dark, spent the night in the cottage. Just as he was about to fall asleep in one of the dusty bedrooms, Angus heard footsteps outside, and then a loud tapping at the front window. Dressing quickly, the old fisherman descended to the ground floor to investigate. Louder and louder grew the tapping noises. Glancing toward the window, Angus clearly saw the bearded face of a sailor looking into the cottage. He wore a jacket with brass buttons and a peaked officer's cap. Yet when the fisherman went outside and looked about Sandwood Cottage and the nearby beach, he could see no one. He also looked for footprints, but found none except his own. On a similar occasion, some months later, Angus again spent the night at the deserted cottage. While he did not see the seafaring man this time, he was awakened during the night by weird thumping noises. He also had the strange feeling that he was being suffocated by a dense, hateful atmosphere pressing down upon his body. Another local man, a shepherd named Sandy Gunn, also had occasion to pass a night in Sandwood Cottage. He told some friends that he had clearly heard ghostly shuffling footsteps downstairs. Searching the entire house, Sandy reported that he had found nothing out of the ordinary. In the late 1960s, two Englishmen spent the night in Sandwood Cottage. They felt too weary to continue their long hike that evening and planned to go on next morning to Clinkbervie, where they would catch a bus to Lairg. In the early morning hours, they were awakened by thudding noises, and soon the whole cottage began to shudder with thunderous bangings and crashes. Unlike Morrison and Gunn, the two men were sleeping downstairs, and the sound seemed to issue from the empty rooms above them. Terrified, they listened to doors being flung open and slammed shut again, windows being smashed, and ponderous tramping footsteps, loud enough to have been made by a horse. The following day, in Kinlochbervie, the Englishmen confided to the postmaster that no sum of money could ever persuade them to spend another night in Sandwood Cottage. Curious tourists still make expeditions to the haunted beach that rings bleakly beautiful Sandwood Bay. And once in a while, roaming among the wrecked ships and ghostly sand dunes, some tell of glimpsing a strange, stocky, seafaring man wearing a peaked officer's cap and a brass-buttoned jacket. In this curious apparition case, it may have been, and perhaps still is, the earthbound spirit body of a once-living man lingering about this area for some reason. Perhaps to say the ship was wrecked offshore and he was drowned. Or maybe, judging from what he said to the farmer and his son, he once owned property on Sandwood Bay, and still, long after his death, resents the intrusion of living persons on it.